The Bernstein and McKnight Show.
I thought we did really well. Just making him work, picking him up higher so he's not just, you know, walking into their offense. When he's dribbling the ball up, pick him up, make him work. You know, don't allow him to just move at his own pace and play comfortable. And I thought, once again, Chief, Ennis, Mo, Zach had a huge game tonight. Had a huge impact on the game. And just making him work. And when he does get on the block, making him see bodies, stunting at the post, double teaming, having active hands when he's trying to make plays, when he's going up at the rim, contesting all his shots. If you're out of position, make him make those free throws. You know, don't let him just lay the ball in. And I thought over 48 minutes, we was there. You know, we made him work for the entire game, and I thought it worked in our favor.
Middays on the Score.
Well, that's quite a scouting report for a big fat guy that can't jump. That's a lot of stuff you got to do for
really
a guy
good.
Who he can't really run, he can't jump, but he's just really damn good at basketball. Damian Lillard on Nikola Jokic. Top of the hour brought to you by Northwestern Football. Don't miss your chance to watch Big Ten football at Ryan Field this fall. The Big Ten West champion Northwestern Wildcats host Ohio State, Michigan State, and more. Season tickets on sale now at nusports.com. Brian Geltzeiler knows NBA. He is Hoops Critic at Hoops Critic on Twitter, hoopscritic.com, Sirius XM, and NBA TV. Hello, Geltzy. How are you?
I'm good, guys. How we doing?
This is a good time of year. I think even casual NBA fans, when it comes around to the conference semis and all the quality and all the star power, this is a time where people tend to seek this game out, and it's so good. It's so good. I want to start with the drama or lack thereof of what was going on in the West with the referees and the gamesmanship, and I get really tired of it. I covered Phil Jackson and George Karl in those series about who's playing illegal defense and who's not, and I think it gets tiresome for some people. It was great that both coaches apparently told their guys to knock it off, and the basketball came through.
Yeah, you know what? I was happy about that, but let's face it. Both coaches have been guilty of enabling their players for far too long. And Steve Kerr, in a credit to him, and it's funny because I talked to both of these coaches in Vegas last summer, and Kerr, at the time, the concern with the Warriors and the officials was much greater than the Rockets. And they had just signed DeMarcus Cousins, and I brought it up to Kerr. And Kerr was pretty candid in the fact that he felt like with Draymond Green and DeMarcus Cousins, a lot of it was calculated. They know about the numbers in terms of the text. But Durant was the one he was concerned about. And then early in the season, he got concerned about everybody and tried to get out in front of it. You kind of felt like the horse left the barn a little bit. But credit Steve Kerr, because a consistent approach on not letting his guys get too hung up on officials. And again, they had an ugly incident in Minnesota late in the season where Steph Curry was mocking an official, and I think that was also a turning point for Kerr because he did not condone that even in the slightest. He couldn't stand that behavior. And I think what you had here on in Game 1 on Sunday was the fact that the Rockets truly let the officials take them out of the game. The officials came into the game prepared for the Harden foot flop, which is what I like to call it, where, you know, he's getting those feet out to try to tangle a defender. He's going to hit the ground, and he's going to claim its landing space. Landing space is not infinite, guys. You have a certain amount of time of space that you can come down in. You put your legs before that space. You're not going to get calls, and the referees were prepared. I thought they did a nice job. I know there was one they blew, but I thought ultimately not giving the Rockets the benefit of the doubt in that spot was kind of set a tone for what's going to happen in this series. With that said, I agree. Both coaches got out in front of it, and I felt like at least for Game 2, the focus was on what happened on the court by the players, not the officials.
So when the dust settles on this season, we've got a champion, probably the Warriors. Will the NBA do anything about how the Rockets have kind of manipulated some of the officiating, how the conversations have gone, and how players themselves, not just the Rockets, but how players have dealt with referees? Will they and should they do something this offseason?
They probably should, but they won't. I will tell you this. One thing that has absolutely happened already is there's been a conversation with Rockets management regarding this study that they did that they decided to throw out in public, which totally questions the integrity of the result last season, which is something the league's not going to have. So that's something that I'm quite sure they've been out in front of here. When it comes to players, listen, they're not going to do that. The league's in a tough spot. They want to protect their officials the best that they can. By the same token, some of that may end up being, in terms of the officials putting their foot down, is star players that people are paying big money to see getting kicked out of games. League doesn't want that either. So it's a tough spot for them. Listen, I thought Chris Paul should have been suspended for game two. And because he wasn't, I'm kind of happy the Warriors won it. Because he made contact with an official, you get suspended. That's what should have happened. But the league does not want this type of stuff to mar what very well may be their most high-profile series as we lead up to the finals. So I understand what they're trying to do. But ultimately, the players have a lot of power here and really too much power. It's a very hard job to referee an NBA game. And you can sit back and look at a full tape of a game and identify dozens of missed calls on both sides. But this whole perception that has taken root in this league, that somehow the league is rooting for one side or another and the officials are complicit in that, I think it's kind of a slippery slope and it's dangerous. With that said, I think if the league makes too much effort to try to curtail some of this complaining, they kind of play into that narrative also. So it's a tight spot here, and ultimately having your star players on the floor, that the guys that people are paying to watch, is still the ideal scenario for the league.
You know what's hilarious? There's some immutable truths of playoff basketball we always conveniently forget until we're reminded of them again, and that is that a 7-game playoff series isn't really engaged until a home team loses, and the other is not every early game plan is necessarily portentous. When the Celtics throttled the Bucks in Game 1, out of the gate and holding off a couple of rallies and stifling Giannis with a defensive helps and recoveries and clogging his running lanes in the middle, so many people immediately after like, well, that's it. This is he's overmatched. There's nothing he can do. I'm thinking, come on, we've been here before. If somebody is an MVP-level player, they can make up for it. They can adjust. They can do different things. They can go over and around you. And we should have known that this was coming. Where do you see this series now? We saw the first shot there, the first Brad Stevens decision. What is he holding back now? What's next?
Well, I don't think, first of all, I think if you ask Brad Stevens, he would tell you that he's quite happy to leave Milwaukee at 1-1. That you know, what they were able to do in Game 1 and what they were able to establish was significant. Now, yes, there were some adjustments made regarding Mike Budenholzer and Giannis offensively. They used them down on the low block, create some more space for the shooters. I think the Celtics kind of collapsed too much on him. They left, I mean, Chris Middleton loaded up on corner threes. That's not something that can happen. And the Celtics had some defensive lapses. But I will tell you, I'm concerned about Milwaukee on the defensive end of the floor because the Celtics missed a whole lot of open shots in Game 2. Now, granted, Milwaukee missed some open shots as well in Game 1, but they throttled Giannis pretty good in Game 1. He did unleash Giannis a little bit, and I do think that you're probably going to see more Horford one-on-one and less doubling of Giannis, with the thought for Brad Stevens is that we don't necessarily have to, you know, shutting down Giannis is not going to happen more times than not, but we can't let Chris Middleton score 28 points. Like, so that's where you're going to see some added focus here in terms of what Boston does defensively. But I'm concerned about Milwaukee defensively. I don't think they've looked great defensively. And I do think one of the keys to Milwaukee on the offensive end of the floor is getting Malcolm Brogdon back, because it's easier to guard Giannis and keep him from getting to the rack and being able to contest with multiple guys when he's the primary ball handler. When Brogdon's on the floor, he'll take a lot of that, gives him another spot-up shooter, an important player for them. But again, the Bucks had a great regular season. They also feasted a lot on bad competition. The Celtics are playing at the highest level they've played all year, and I have grave concerns. Listen, Kyrie Irving had 9 points and shot 4 of 18 in Game 2, and the Celtics just kind of lumped up in the second half and had trouble scoring. That's a rarity. That's not going to happen a ton, and I just feel like Milwaukee has to do a much better and more effective job on the defensive end of the floor. The Celtics really roll a lot of offensive talent at you. I don't know that Milwaukee's going to be able to handle it in the long run.
Monday night, the Sixers even things up on the Raptors at 1. Jimmy Butler had a terrific night with 30. Joel Embiid had the bubble guts. The Raptors missed a whole bunch of shots. Pascal Siakam was good but not efficient. I can't help but think that the Raptors, even though they missed as many shots as they did Monday, are in a really good spot in this series.
You know, I'm not sure I agree.
Okay.
And I'll tell you, and listen, I like the Raptors a lot. I think they're incredibly talented. But there was a major defensive adjustment made by Brett Brown. He moved Embiid over to Siakam and took him off Gasol and put Tobias Harris on Gasol and pretty much dared Nick Nurse to use Gasol in the low post. Now, again, when they got back in the game a little bit in the third quarter, they ran a lot through Marc Gasol. But Marc Gasol these days is much more passer than he is scorer. So Gasol in the low post, I'll take my chances with Tobias Harris on him, knowing that the likely outcome there is that Gasol's kicking it out and I want to patrol shooters. The other thing is this, Siakam likes the blocks, he likes the baseline. Putting Embiid on him brought Embiid down to the baseline and made him a little bit more of a help defense factor than with Gasol hanging on the perimeter. That was another major adjustment. And again, I thought the story of the game wasn't necessarily how well Butler scored. I thought it was how well Philly played defense. Listen, Kawhi Leonard right now to me is the second best player in the NBA behind Kevin Durant. Kawhi Leonard had 35 points on 23 shots in that game. I thought Ben Simmons did a tremendous job defending him, making life very hard on him. And in the end, the Raptors, and you worry about the Raptors as well, who's going to be my second scorer? It hasn't been Lowry all year. They needed it to be Lowry in that game. And don't get me wrong, Lowry had 20, but he had to work for everything. And the thing about Kyle Lowry being the second scorer, the ball's got to be in his hands all the time to do it. And if it's in his hands, it's not in Kawhi's. And that's the thing with the emergence of Siakam as that second score. Siakam's a guy that doesn't have to have the ball in his hands. He gets it, he makes a move and goes up with it. Kawhi's a little bit more methodical in terms of, and you see Kawhi initiate some offense for them sometimes just because it's an express route to get the ball in his hands. So with them having a need for Lowry and kind of the Sixers putting that pressure on them, I'm worried about the Raptors in this series. Here's the other thing with the Sixers, and you can't forget this about them. They have three elite-level defensive players on that team in Embiid, Butler, and Simmons. As good as their offense was to be able to pull that game out, and they were able to win a game with Butler getting 30 and Embiid not doing much, as good as their offense was, their defense was the star of that game. Their defense was tremendous. And if they can continue to defend at this level in their own building against the Raptors, I think the Raptors could be in trouble here.
All right, Coach, if you're putting Embiid on Siakam, why aren't I getting Siakam involved in screen and roll between the rings, wing screen and roll, pulling Embiid away from the basket, forcing him to defend with his hands and maybe foul?
I think that's a very smart way to go about it. I think you're going to see Siakam more tonight as a screener in screen and roll.
Why not ball handler? Why not have the smaller player? Why not have him actually with the ball?
You take him out of his game a little bit.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Siakam's a guy, and Siakam will score a lot for you, but he's spot up, and he's a guy that'll go into the post and do things in the paint for you. Not that he's a bad player off the bounce, but I do think if your primary threat's going to be Siakam off the bounce, A, you're taking it out of Leonard's hands, and you have to always remember the straw that stirs that drink there. Kawhi Leonard's not DeMar DeRozan. Kawhi Leonard, you have to have the ball in his hands as frequently as possible. So, yes, and I think you will see some sets based upon that. With the ball in Siakam's hands, with Siakam as a screener in screen and roll, they will try to pull Embiid to the perimeter and get him in some mismatches, especially with the fact that Joel Embiid, with the time that he sat, looks like he's carrying an extra 15 pounds around his middle and isn't moving as well as we would expect him to move, especially with the bad knee. So that you certainly will see some of that tonight, but I think for the Raptors, that can be a slippery slope, and you got to be careful. Leonard is still the guy that has to have the ball in his hands the majority of the time.
While we're doing pick and roll porn here, I know Jamal Murray has got that injured thigh, but I have to tell you that when you watch Jamal Murray and Jokic do some of what they do, those of us of a certain age, when we imagine a playoff NBA screen roll and all the various permutations, we think Stockton Malone.
Right.
And we think little guy and the big strong guy who is either going to flatten out and shoot or he's going to go right to the basket. When the big man is actually the better passer, it's fantastic. It's when he can shoot it and pass it, and all of a sudden they're running around the maypole, and it's like Wilt Chamberlain on the early 70s Lakers. That's really cool stuff.
You know, it's funny. I love Nikola Jokic, and just because he is his his whole skill level is so off the charts in terms of what he does with the ball in his hands, the kind of post player he is, the kind of passer, the kind of ball handler. I mean, you see Jokic bring the ball up sometimes, and it doesn't look awkward, you know? And then there's the part of me that imagine if this guy got himself into really good shape and was ripped, how good he could be. I mean, he's running around the court with a body like me, guys. You know, it's amazing what he does. Listen, they lost the game last night that they should have won. They missed. They had 14 offensive rebounds in the fourth quarter. They missed the volume of bunnies that they missed late in that game. You can't even make it up. I mean, they just missed so many easy shots. And I thought Portland was malpractice how poorly they boxed out. And you saw last night how badly they missed Yusuf Nurkic, because that was a spot where Yusuf Nurkic would have been coming down with rebounds. That never would have happened if Nurkic was on the floor. With that said, I still like the way the Nuggets are positioned in this series. I think they found something last night playing some bully ball against Portland. It's not necessarily their game, but I think they can push Portland around a little bit. And it was almost fluky that they missed so many bunnies last night in that fourth quarter. It was a game there for the taking. The Nuggets obviously regret not getting it, but I do think that formula is something that the Blazers, as good as Zach Collins played last night, as well as he looked, Cantor's got a bad shoulder. That's a tough thing for the Blazers right now. The Blazers are really susceptible to being pushed around, and Nikola Jokic and Paul Millsap are damn good at pushing people around.
Brian, this is great. I could talk all day, and I know we will again before the playoffs come to an end. Great reset on everything that's going on across the NBA. Thanks for your time.
Guys, always my pleasure. We'll do it again soon. Take care.
Brian Geltzeiler.
God, that's good.
Oh, that's good. NBA TV, SiriusXM, HoopsCritic.com. You want to follow him on Twitter? He is at HoopsCritic. Midday Midway coming your way. I have a new definition of meat pants, and I have a story.
I didn't know we needed to redefine meat pants.
I am not much of a bourbon drinker.
Oh, yeah. But, all right. But I can help out there.
But I've got reading about the bourbon explosion in a way that really made me want bourbon.
Okay. I could have brought some in for leftovers or something if you'd have let me know. There is a new public service coming to Chicago. We will do a public service for Chicago, and there's a cruise ship that you do not want to be on for several reasons.
Any of the reasons.
The Midday Midway
is cruise ships.
On the way. It's Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
The first half or the second half, you know, they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel it.
The Midday Midway with Bernstein and McKnight on The Score.
Started the show by asking a question of the Cubs at 16 and 12 and playing their best baseball right now that we usually ask a little bit later. Four games removed from 500, four games free. Have they reached escape velocity? Will they ever be close to 500 again? Have they become a winning team for 2019? And the answer was split.
Very split. It's a weird week coming up for them. Three against the Cardinals, four against the... I almost said a word I can't say about the Marlins, but they're very bad. And then you've got the Brewers as well.
Execrable, if you would like
to. I could. That is absolutely. That would describe the words I almost said about the Miami Marlins.
You could say that. We also discussed John Lester, what he's doing right. We talked about where the ball has to be in the strike zone now, that you can't work low consistently like Lester used to do.
Spotted it yesterday.
Pounding the bottom of the zone. He was able to move eye levels, use the backdoor cutter, and strike people out by working upward. That's an old dog learning a new trick.
It was a little bit yesterday. Also, the Mariners are just terrible on defense. My God, was that bad. There's a public service coming to Chicago. We've talked about it a couple of times on the Midday Midway, but this got written up in the Trib yesterday, and I wanted to bring it to everyone's attention because as optimistic as I am about something like this working in our fair city, I just don't have high hopes. This is written by Mary Wisniewski's contact reporter for the Trib. The headline reads, "The scooters are coming. Chicago announces electric scooter pilot program."
Phoenix.
West of Halsted Street. Yeah, we saw those things when we were driving around Phoenix.
They're divvy bikes, except they're scooters.
That's exactly what they are. Shared electric scooters, which have been a source of both fun and controversy in other cities, are coming to Chicago next month. The city on Wednesday released details of a pilot program allowing electric scooter sharing in a large section of the Northwest, Southwest, and West Sides, including such diverse neighborhoods as Austin, Avondale, Pilsen, South Lawndale, but leaving out the Loop and communities along the lakefront. It goes into the program and talking about how it could be good being an affordable, environmentally friendly transportation solution. Very excited to test it. Also a source of contention because they litter sidewalks and pose a safety hazard to riders and pedestrians. I have high hopes for this. Like, I want it to work.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went to Phoenix with two old score guys, Dennis Gambino and Adam Harris, so we go for the Arizona fall trip just about every year. And they have them there, right? They have the scooters.
And they're piled up on corners.
We stayed close to, this time we happened to stay close to the Sloan Park in Mesa. Not close enough to walk, mind you. But while we were there, we grabbed a bunch of scooters. Like, we commandeered these things, parked them outside of the, you know, apartment complex that we were staying in the Airbnb at, and hoped that they would be there, that like three of the nine that we just kind of drove over there, because there's nothing against it, would be there when we got up the next morning. It was hit and miss, half and half. Some were there, some weren't. But if we, with fairly decent intentions, and not at all like being a complete jerk about things, were like just commandeering scooters and driving them over to an Airbnb so the next morning we could just scooter to In-N-Out, if we were doing that, these things are going to end up on roofs, and they're going to end up in driveways, and they're going to end up in the lake. I do not have high hopes for this program.
When I was in LA, they had those everywhere, and people would just ditch them in alleys, on the beach,
they're disposable.
In the street.
At a certain point, people just treat them as disposable things.
Yeah, I'll put it on a roof. See if
someone
finds
happen.
It.
What's going to happen around Wrigley? Like, Wrigley's a zoo on game days.
I was thinking about that. I wonder if there are a couple of areas. Like, for ride shares, they block out Wrigley Field. There's only a couple of places that rideshare drivers can pick you up. I think there's like four different points supposed to pick you up. Obviously, like a drive wherever. But I wonder if the scooters are going to know once you get to a certain area that they just have to shut it down. You know, like when you're on a golf course with the really fancy golf carts and you get close to the green and it just shuts you down. Maybe you do something like that.
In 1999, there were fewer than 20 distilleries in Kentucky, producing about 455,000 barrels of bourbon. Now there are 68 distilleries that filled 1.7 million barrels last year and have provided the infrastructure for what's become a massive tourist attraction with 1.5 million visitors, mostly from out of state, annually on the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. It's got to be from Kentucky to be bourbon. This is proprietary. It's like in AVA. This is something that's why Jack right. Daniels has to call itself Tennessee whiskey. Even though the ingredients are similar, it is not bourbon. And when you say why and how did this happen? Well, there's a confluence of many things, according to USA Today. Good fortune with younger people embracing spirits. Bartenders at high-end establishments using bourbon to craft interesting drinks. The idea of crafting drinks and mixology.
Yeah, so.
They also credit Mad Men. The success of the TV show Mad Men.
Oh, that did get big. Did you watch that show?
I did. My wife has seen it. I have seen some of it.
I watched
a few
handful.
Episodes. It's fun. It helped revive the old-fashioned that's long gone out of style and has created...
There's a time and a place for a good old-fashioned. I've always said that.
Created small-batch bourbons like Pappy Van Winkle, and it spoke to a younger generation of people more concerned about taste and complexity than whatever could give them a buzz. What I did not know was, while we always talk about the demise of horse racing and the problems that horse racing faces, bourbon's relationship to horse racing has been enormously successful. And this is with the Kentucky Derby coming and mint juleps and all that. Woodford Reserve became the presenting sponsor of the Kentucky Derby, replacing Yum Brands. Old Forester owns the Turf Classic race before the Derby. Old Forester being like the oldest operating distillery. And there are other tracks and other races that have had all kinds of success because of the festival, the party nature of it. It has found a way. Horse racing success stories now has been connecting it with the bourbon industry and the fact that bourbon comes from Kentucky. And what I did not know, what I had no idea, is and this is lofty sort of advertising stuff, but it's actually kind of cool. The president of the Distillers Association says every sip of Kentucky bourbon brings memories of rolling green hills and white fences and galloping foals. It's the perfect symbol of the state. They say you can get a good red wine from four continents, a smooth vodka from Russia or from Texas, a craft beer from every small town brewery. It's the unique water with the infusion of calcium carbonate, potassium, magnesium, and zinc that gives bourbon its distinct taste. Now, it goes a step further. Let me give you a little latitude here,
bourbon
please,
nerds.
Your Honor. And I'm not a bourbon nerd. I just
think there are so many of them.
It's not the water isn't just the bourbon. All the magic of Churchill Downs, the true believers believe, is due to the water. It flows over the limestone that is natural to the state's geology.
Of course, yeah.
Filling it with these specific minerals that end up feeding the bluegrass, which makes the young horses who graze on it strong and fast. So it is the water itself that is of the Kentucky bourbon, of the bluegrass, and of the horses.
Bourbon nerds. This from NBC News. A cruise ship with nearly 300 passengers and crew was ordered quarantine in the Caribbean port of St. Lucia after a case of measles was confirmed on board. Island health officials said Wednesday. One female crew member has a confirmed case, and St. Lucian authorities said they've been working in close consultation with the Pan American Health Organization and the Caribbean Public Health Agency. The ship has been under quarantine since Monday morning. Measles is a highly contagious disease. Anyone who's not adequately immunized against measles can contract the disease if there's been any close contact with it. It's therefore likely that other persons on the boat may have been exposed.
What if you have extra body thetans? Does that make it worse?
The doctor has confirmed the case in isolation on the ship. The individual is in stable condition, which is good. The St. Lucian health officials declined to name the ship involved, but St. Lucia Coast Guard Sergeant Victor Theodore, great name. That sounds like a double A hitter with some really solid gap-to-gap power.
Batting first, number 6, Victor Theodore.
So Theodore told NBC News that the vessel involved is named Free Winds, which is the name of a 440-foot cruise ship owned and operated by the Church of Scientology. Theodore identified the quarantine craft as the same one that's listed on the church's website. While no one's been allowed to leave the ship, although I don't think they were going to be allowed to leave anyway, St. Lucian authorities said they don't have the authority to keep it from leaving.
Once you earn your trip on the Scientology ship, that's like after you've paid X amount of money for your auditing sessions and removal of your body thetans from the volcano on Xenu.
I think that's how that works, yes.
I'm dead serious. From what I understand, that's like one of the big – you're a big shooter. You've given a ton of income to that particular tax-free church.
It's beautiful, isn't it? I mean, just that whole cruise ship.
You know what we have? That we have a Lazaretto.
That is a Lazaretto.
That is a Lazaretto.
Mark Lazaretto?
That is the people hear the song by Jack White. Is it White Stripes or just Jack White?
I always forget White that Stripes. One. I think that's White Stripes.
And it's a wild song called Lazaretto. A Lazaretto is a ship used for the purposes of quarantine. We literally have a Lazaretto. Let the record
Jay's
show.
Right. It's a Jack White song. It just couldn't happen to better people.
And the texters are mad at me saying bourbon doesn't have to come from Kentucky. I meant to say that true Kentucky bourbon is considered a specific thing that obviously must be in Kentucky.
Territorial.
Right, that. They are. Extremely. I have a Florida man for you.
Ah, I love Florida men. That'll come back.
According to the Martin County Sheriff's Office in Florida, Mayeli Alvarez Aguilar, 26, was booked on a petty merchant theft charge. Caught walking out of a grocery store in Indiantown, Florida. He had a full rack of ribs in his pants.
Big pants.
My guy! See, that's... Now, that's... Okay, that's funny, right?
Full rack of ribs?
He had a rack of ribs in his pants. He just slid them down there, and that's not the best part.
Where are my rib pants?
Honey, where are my rib pants? Ribs weren't the only item police found in the man's pants. Also in his pants, two packs of hamburger buns, 9 pieces of fried chicken, and this is my favorite, and what is described as some mashed potatoes.
Some.
Right.
Not all.
Not a container of mashed potatoes. Just mashed potatoes are in there.
We know how many mashed potatoes he took.
Maybe
they didn't all make it to
the
pants.
How many scoops off the hot bar? Right there is he lining the underpants with maybe a little gravy, too.
Mm, that's the right of mashed potatoes.
That's perfect. The stuff. The combined value of the items pilfered totaled $32.49. The report added that Aguilar Alvarez was intoxicated and smelled of alcohol and elderberries when he was arrested.
So I thought you were going to say he had coleslaw and baked beans and some cornbread tucked into his pants. Apparently not. Okay, the list is out. The Chicago Tribune a week ago listed the best fries in the city for $5 and under.
Ooh.
I will tweet the entire list.
Non-fast food?
These are local joints. These are local joints. There is not, as best I can tell, there is not a quote-unquote franchise fast food place on this list. Your top 20.
Wait, no more.
Yeah, I'll let you think for a little bit.
No more hot dogs, duck fries.
No, I'll spin for a little bit here. You start thinking. Fats get in there as well. This is your stuff. This is my stuff, too. God, there are some great places on this list. And some
is Ocheval
that I hadn't heard of. I will give you your top five, and then we'll scroll through for favorites.
Does Al's Beef count?
No, Al's Beef is not on this list.
Whoa.
They went to 106 restaurants among food and dining reporters and editors. The whole staff got to eating. They narrowed it down. It's just on the way home. Narrowed it down to 20. Your top five read as such. Rand Red Hots was number five out in Des Plaines.
Okay.
That is your number five spot. The Illinois Bar and Grill on West 47th Street. That is number four.
The Illinois Bone and Joint
Institute. It's very good fries.
I had no idea.
Also great ribs.
Right. Insurance pays for them.
4,000 West Grand. You've got Jimmy's Red Hots. Solid.
Wait,
fries.
is that Elmwood Park? Is that the famous beef place?
West Humboldt. Yeah, so I think that would be.
Right on the border. Jimmy's Beef, I thought.
It's a local joint.
Okay.
Local joint made good. This is right by the house. Red Hot Ranch on Western, the number two under $5 fry in the city.
Red Hot
Ranch.
You
get
Ranch.
Those bad boys with
really?
A little bit of the cheese. Oh my God, Dan, that's what's up. Mr. D's Shish Kebabs took the honors for best fry in the city, 6656 West Diversey, according to everybody at the Tribune who ranked these puppies. They had the best fries in the city. I'll tweet the whole list. You can quibble, you can argue, but that is the spot to go.
I'd like to challenge local newspapers.
Challenge away.
Travel south of Cermak every now and again. And try something. It's like anything south of Cermak doesn't exist.
You got a suggestion?
Trigger!
I have millions of suggestions. It's kind of frustrating that some great places on the south side don't even get looked at. It sucks.
Apparently,
Johnny's is the beef place. Jimmy's is Grand and Pulaski.
Okay. The only place it looks like it would fit Jay's criteria for south would be Top-Notch Beef Burgers.
And Top-Notch is it's a chain. It's all over the South Side, so you almost kind of can't ignore it.
Well, but they did pick the one on 95th.
I've talked about Rosangela's Pizza as one of my absolute favorite pizza place in the state, or in the world, in the universe. Their fries are also awesome there. But, you know, you'd have to go, you have to go south. No one wants to do that.
Noted, man. Let it
trigger.
Let it eat.
Red Ranch. There's one on Western. There's one on Ashland.
You gotta go to the one on Western, too. Cash only. So bring your
I've driven by it 100 times.
Oh, it's great. Absolutely fantastic.
That has been the Midday Midway, brought to you by Northwestern Football. At the bottom of the hour, join Coach Fitz of the Big Ten West Division and Holiday Bowl champions at Ryan Field this fall when they host Ohio State, Iowa, Michigan State, and more. Season tickets on sale now at nusports.com. We got some White Sox thoughts, too. Tim Anderson is being the outspoken guy leaning in and embracing his stardom. I wish the team would help him out a little bit more than just on Instagram.
Hug him tightly.
Hug him tightly and put him out there for people. And I'm trying to figure out what's going on with Carlos Rodon, and I've got some stats that aren't lying.
Yeah, we had a guy we hadn't seen in a while open some eyes, too, yesterday in a doubleheader against the horrible, horrible Orioles team. We'll get to the White Sox when we come back. It's Bernstein McKnight, 670 The Score.
There was one quote about you saying you'd feel like the new Jackie Robinson in a sense. Can you explain a little bit about that? Because I just saw the quote.
Just more so on the side of,
just trying to have fun. You know, they don't want me to have fun. So I think it's cool when you bring, you know, excitement to the game, and you bring something different. And I think, you know, I think I bring something different to the game, and that's a lot of energy and a lot of excitement.
Do you feel any pushback from people on what you do?
That's just noise. Don't pay attention to them.
Make your own noise, Tim Anderson. Talking with the Score's Bruce Levine. The segment brought to you by Door Systems. Call 1-800-THE-DOOR.
Tim's been fun to watch all season long. Tim's been fun to listen to all season long. And he's stirred up some controversy and he stirred up some excitement where sometimes it's been difficult to find it in baseball. Sometimes with the White Sox, it's been difficult to find it. I'm really enjoying Tim. And I know that some people are going to take him to task for saying that he's the next Jackie Robinson, or he feels like Jackie Robinson or whatever. I'll let him do that on
his
own.
He wasn't being disrespectful.
No, he wasn't.
He wasn't at all. Very far from it. He walks the walk and talks the talk. Yeah. He's got his own youth baseball startup organization on the South Side and all sorts of empowerment stuff. He took a bunch of high school kids to go see 42 on Jackie Robinson Day. I mean, the guy's a real dude.
It's not my place to criticize that. It's just not. I have no grounds to do so. I can tell you, though, that when he... It was Jackie Robinson Day 3 years ago. It was 2017 Jackie Robinson Day. Go back. I'll try and find the photo. I took a picture of it. I'm kind of a cleat nerd, you know, like kind of a shoe nerd when it gets to it. I love the trend going around. A lot of pitchers have taken Air Jordans, and there's a company that'll scoop out the bottoms of your Jordans.
Oh, they can make anything cleats?
And put cleats on them. And they won't be gamers. Like no professional would play in like scooped out Jordans like that. But a lot of pitchers will run out and like shag fly balls with them or something like that. They'll wear their Jordans to go do their warm-ups throughout the day. And
that's
they're
cool.
They're awesome. They really are. But for Jackie Robinson Day in 2017, Tim had the most badass pair of cleats to commemorate the Jackie. It was like the line that Adidas was doing, and it was like white, copper, and black. They were just the best look you could possibly imagine. And he's wearing these. It was just great. I'll try and find the photo and tweet him out. But yeah, you're right. The guy has absolutely walked a walk. I find them incredibly fun to watch. And you've seen the commercial that NBC Sports has done now too, with it's him out in Glendale doing that whole thing where he's trying to take a base, and it's just a close up of his face, things like that. I'm ready for more of that. I'm ready to see the new White Sox get put on display a little bit for their fans. And I find it kind of fun that, you know, it's not a guy. You know, the lead of this thing isn't a guy that you picked up in the Chris Sale trade or the Adam Eaton trade or the Jose Quintana trade, though Eloy Jimenez probably will be. He's on the shelf with the ankle right now. But the most outspoken, the most entertaining, and the player with the most gravity right now is Tim Anderson, your homegrown guy.
Your first round pick.
The guy that you drafted higher than a lot of other teams had the stomach to draft him. A guy that you signed to an extension early on. At the time, check me if I'm wrong on this, Scott Kingery, I think, beat him for the highest. Oh, no, Kingery didn't play any Major League Baseball. He's the highest contract value for the least amount of service time. That's what Tim Anderson got. Nobody had been paid more after playing less baseball, the most guaranteed money. It's an incredible deal for this team. And if Tim Anderson achieves, even to this level, with some of the streaky stuff that he's going to have, it's terrific, terrific value.
And they're doing it on Instagram. They're doing it on their social media platforms. But there have to be some other ways of putting him out there, of getting him in front of you, of getting however you want to market it. I mean, I remember even when Darren Erstad had a couple of diving catches and Brooks Boyer was right out with these grinder T-shirts and all that. And they had made sure their broadcast was selling it in certain ways. Tim Anderson is going to run into a rut because he doesn't walk very much. He swings at everything.
And most players do.
Yeah, but he's more prone to vacillations in this, more prone to these feasts and famines because of his offensive approach. So make hay when you can. Do this now. Get on it. You'll market it fresh and shiny and new, and he's handsome, and he smiles a lot. And I know he's not the best talker, but whether you're Major League Baseball or the White Sox, you know, work on it a little bit.
Yeah, and
uncomfortable.
I think, you know, when we talked about Tim, what was it, Monday or something like that, we were having a discussion about how well he's playing and how much production he's kind of handing out here. And many have said, even White Sox fans, I've heard this some, that if Tim is the best player on this team, then you're in a little bit of trouble. I understand where you're coming from with that. I understand that premise. But I think what's important here, and what kind of sucks about Jimenez's injury more than just not being able to watch him, is that you've got a chance with a bunch of these young players and Yoan Moncada kind of regaining some of the skill set or some of the production that he was projected to have. You've got players that can buoy him a little bit in the lineup. That's not to say that you've got enough. And, you know, when I saw it, it sucks that Corey Kluber went down after a comebacker to the arm. That looks rough, and who knows how long he's going to be out. Clevinger is going to sit out for a little while, and I think I read that he had a setback with the back as well, so I don't know how long that's going to be for him. Carlos Carrasco is dealing with some issues and skated past an MRI clean.
Yeah, it would be right here, right?
You know, I just, this division, the Indians knew they didn't have to do much to keep a hold on it. They just needed their players to be their players. They needed their guys to be their guys, and that hasn't happened. They've had some injuries. The Twins are a wonderful defensive ball club and have an offense that works, but that pitching is suspect. It's suspect. It's just a couple of things here and there. You know, if a couple of signs, you're hitting on this, and I'm not even talking about missing on Manny Machado anymore, though if you want to, you can definitely throw this in. Man, you had a chance to make this real interesting, and you still could, but it's a division that wants to be made interesting, and why not make it interesting with one of the most fun Tim Anderson seasons you can have?
If and when the Sox are good, Carlos Rodon is going to have to be a big part of it, and there have been continued high expectations for this guy, and I'm just looking at some numbers. He just got in his own way yesterday, or maybe actually couldn't get out of his
Carlos?
Own way yesterday.
Yeah, he'll do that.
And he gets funky physically, and it looks, I don't know if it's pouting so much as his frustration is worn on his sleeve. And because he pitches somewhat emotionally.
Get on his chest because he doesn't wear an undershirt.
Yeah, I mean, just you can see it physically, and I might be projecting some of my feelings on it when I watch him.
That's pretty natural to watch pitching, though.
Yeah, this is not projected here. Obviously, the fastball, slider, and change as the data collected by Fangraphs, usage of his fastball is the lowest it's ever been. Career-wise, he's 60%. He's at 51.9. This goes along with league patterns.
Yeah, I see no problems with that.
I'm not saying there's a problem here. Slider usage is way up from a career rate of 28.1 now to 37.4. Changeup rate
goodness.
Holding steady. But he is relying on his slider or sliders more than ever. Here's what also jumps off the page at me right now with Carlos Rodon. I'm going to read you some numbers, and I'm starting in 2015.
Okay.
This is fastball velocity. 93.4, 93.4, 93.1, 93, 91.5. Remember what Joe Sheehan told us about for every mile an hour.
One click is about four-tenths
of ERA. Slider velocity, starting in 2015. 87.3, 86.7, 85, 85.4, 83.8.
Feels like something for Steve Stone to get his hands on, doesn't it?
This is, again,
to kind of analyze.
Well, you can, but I don't want to overanalyze it. And I'm not saying he's hurt, but I'm saying he is a major league pitcher who with a repaired shoulder, not a repaired elbow. Elbows can be restored. Shoulders can be repaired, but not necessarily restored. And you don't have to look too far in White Sox history to know how some of this stuff has gone with some guys for whom they had high hopes and paid a lot of money and really liked their work and how they had to change who they were and how they went about their business. It is obviously early. I am not drawing any conclusions here. I'm just reminding you a baseball truth that once your shoulder's cut on, at first it's biceps bursitis or it's this, it's radiating pain or it's a stress reaction. No, he had a bad shoulder. And they had to clean it out surgically and shut him down for a while. Pitchers aren't the same when they have shoulder problems.
Yeah, but his stuff works in similar. It's not John Danks. It's not a guy who lives on power cutter and change who then loses velocity and can't make the differential between one and the other work.
He's down 2 miles an hour on his fastball. He is down 4 miles an hour on his slider.
That's not good. I get that. That's not good.
All I'm saying.
You've got a whole bunch of breaking ball pitchers. You've got a whole bunch of breaking ball specialists. I mean, look at the Astros. They've been able to up their spin rate some as a team because of, I don't know, magic or something. And that helps. But if you've got the stuff to tumble the way that Carlos does, you can still get by with things. I told you, I think, last year.
I'm not saying you can't. I'm just saying that this is a very real, tangible reason and evidence that he may be a different pitcher ever since he had a shoulder operation.
If Carlos is going to be the guy who cannot get a fastball over consistently from start to start, from month to month, then losing clicks off the miles per hour will really hurt him, because you cannot miss in the strike zone when you're down to 91. That's just going to get pummeled.
This is Jim in Mount Greenwood on the Score. Hi, Jim.
Hey, guys. Good morning. Hey, just a couple quick points. I appreciate Tim Anderson, and if he is a voice for the African-American community and he's going to promote baseball within that community, I think that's awesome. Obviously, we know the lack of African-Americans there are in Major League Baseball. But I've been hearing this word kind of thrown around lately, and that is stardom or superstar. I mean, we also can't – you guys are big Fangraph guys. The last 2 years, he was a 78 WRC plus and an 85 last year coming into this year.
Mm-hmm.
He's negative eight defensive runs saved already this year. He's still a pretty awful fielder. I mean, is he a superstar after 1 month, basically getting a lot of singles with a high BABIP? I mean, he's got 9 extra base hits.
Sure. I wouldn't call him 10 stolen bases, too. I think in 10 tries, which matters in terms of efficiency, I think. I wouldn't call him a superstar now. But I think the reason that I'm as gravitated to him as anybody is because you can see it and you can see the potential. Baseball, I was the guy telling you that Mike Trout isn't marketed well enough by Major League Baseball.
But Tim Anderson's 26. He's not 23.
Sure. Yeah.
You kind of know what he is. I mean, he's had a hot month. I mean, like I said,
he's had an incredible month.
Dan said superstar.
No, I don't believe I said
for the White Sox, who else would you? I mean, you got to think of this from a local standpoint too. For the White Sox, as they try and march back to a 500 ball club, like, who else would you have out in front for this team?
I guess my point is he could be out in front for the White Sox, and like you said, I mean, I think that's where it's kind of getting stretched, and I think there's been so much put into this. And it's basically been based off of 1 month.
He didn't say
he was Jackie Robinson. He didn't say he wanted to be the voice for all this last year when he had an 85 WRC plus. It's just now that he's having 1 good month. If he crashes and burns and regresses like his BABIP, he says he will, and
he
continues to be a bad defense player, is he going to be the face of the organization?
No, I think it's okay in his fun moments, in his moments of success, for him to be expressive. That's wherever and whenever they may be.
He's done that when he was struggling, too.
A couple things, Jimmy. If I said superstar, I didn't mean it. Then you're right to point that out and reel me in on that. I would also say that I love the fact that how informed your call is. I love the fact you just picked up the phone with a little bit of actual information and data, and it advances the conversation in a really positive way, and I think it's a really good example. So it's a very, very good call. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Appreciate it.
When Tim is streaky and on one, that's going to be really good for this team. The key is putting pieces around him to make sure that offense, I'm talking longer term, to make sure that offense can do something while he's just a singles hitter. You know, if the downturn comes around quicker than, the next couple, when he's just a singles hitter, when he's not walking, when he's hopefully making his outs in a productive way or just kind of getting on via error, that's a skill set too. You've got to put the people in the place, the players around him to make sure that his skill set, because it is a little limited, that it can still be a productive one.
We have $1,000 in cash to give away. You got to listen for the keyword to text. We have dinner for five. We had breakfast for all of us at Chewy's.
Breakfast for nine.
Chewy's Tex-Mex restaurants. We are giving that away. And a reminder, we are at Gallagher Way tomorrow. Our show is going to be 9 until 12:45, the extended dance mix of the Bernstein and McKnight Show at Wrigley Field at Gallagher Way. The weather's supposed to be nice. Start your weekend. Come hang out with us, and we'll be talking sports and things with you. Len Casper is going to join us next. I will ask him the question that I asked you to start the show, and we will talk to another smart baseball man. Don't go anywhere. You've got Bernstein and McKnight on the Score.